The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Some content in this audio is not covered under a Creative Commons license. For more information, see the course materials on the MIT OpenCourseWare website.
To Abe, who's going to give us a guest lecture on art games. And today's reading, the Frasca reading, is kind of like part two of a lot of things that Jason Begley talked about when we did simulations. So kind of, if you guys remember his talk while you were reading that paper, you can see where some of that came from. One thing that I actually forgot to stress was that there are actually a couple of responses to that article. If you scroll all the way down to the bottom of the article, there are these responses by Eric Zimmerman and Mizuki Ito, and him back to them. And those are kind of interesting, you know, because it just sort of carries on the conversation, and people are actually just sort of turning his article into basically a blog post and then write comments. And they were pretty good. But a lot of that was kind of the state of art game discussion back in 1999, I think. I think it's a pretty old article. Where they were very much thinking about, you know, games have to be simulations. You know, if games are narratives, blah. Storytelling is like some other medium's domain. It's all about the simulation. And arguably at that time, there wasn't a big discussion of an art games movement. There were other games movements, like new games, like new games, which were really more about people interacting with it, trying to get games to where people were more cooperative, less competitive, and less cutthroat. There were movements about people. There were probably advertising game movements, and there was a lot of work in people making mods of computer games that effectively made it unplayable, but made really pretty images in the process. So that there was a Doom hack, for instance, where everything becomes black and white and is striped, including the monsters. It's like there's no way they can see what the hell's going on, but it looked pretty cool.
Have you seen? I think it's 96 kilobytes. Yeah, there was a competition in a mm-hmm. full game and a really small size. No, it's 4 kilobytes, I think. And it's a 4 kilobyte game in full 3D mm-hmm. with multiple levels, and they do extremely clever, including the music and everything.
Like early, like, yeah.
Have you ever heard of this or seen this?
There are a couple of those. And a lot of those come out from the demo scene. The demo scene, which I will put off to some other time.
It's very artsy, too. It's like very...
Yeah, it's kind of this weird thing of like computer hacking, really, really fast and really, really compact coding and visual aesthetics and music, which you know, it's more of like a digital music video, only there were some people who added a mouse control and gameplay into it and made these tiny little games. But that was pretty much art. That's very different from the art game scene that we have today, or at least what is commonly described as art games. So I'd like Abe to talk about kind of what happened from since 99.
Yeah. So hi guys, I'm Abe. I work here at the lab. I play a bunch of your games. I've met a bunch of you. So it's nice to be here. Philip asked me to come in to talk about quote unquote art games. I think largely because it's a kind of I'll say sector of kind of game development that my work at Gambit tends to intersect with, especially recently. And I think too that it's. It's kind of a sector that's a little bit confused and possibly confusing too. And so just to give you guys a sense, you know, when he asked me about this, it kind of made me think, because I was like, oh yeah, cool, I'll talk about like this art games movement or whatever, but you know, then of course, I'm locked into some kind of weird mode right now. Sorry, okay. That brings up this question, which is art games art. And just to kind of give you a sense for how this little talk thing, whatever, is going to go. I'm going to talk a little bit about this question, give you kind of examples of what people have said about this, and opinions that I think are particularly important, particularly valid on this subject. I also, after that, want to show you some examples, some historical and then kind of moving forward examples. I'm actually going to get some of you guys to just come up here and maybe even play some of these examples that I think are particularly important. And I'd really like it if we can kind of keep this less of a me talking at you and you engaging me as you have questions on this. Because it's really like me, you know, blabbing at you as you fall asleep is you know, maybe good for a nap, but less useful for, you know, getting anything out of this. So we'll try to structure this as a conversation, and I'll try to pull back, harken back to any of my teacher instincts and see if I can get you engaged, but we'll see. So our games are, I hate this question. I'll start off by saying that I fundamentally, and I find it abhorrent, and I hear it all the time. And it's aggravating to me because I think it's incontrovertibly yes. I think that you can't possibly come up with any other answer other than yes, games are art, games have art, yes, 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 right? But it keeps coming up, and it keeps kind of becoming a question. And I should say, too, that this is a wholly biased and slanted talk. This is my perspective on this, and hopefully by the time you're done, you'll be like, wow, he is absolutely right. There is no way that games could be anything but art, or at least they are art and then some. This guy, who's a little hard to see right now, but he's totally blown up, recently brought this into the fore. That's Roger Ebert of Siskel and Ebert fame, or since you guys are some of you younger than me, probably Ebert and Roper. And he had some interesting and controversial comments recently, and I pulled this quote. Nevertheless, I remain convinced that in principle, I love that he put that in italics, video games cannot be art. Perhaps it is foolish of me to say never, because never, as Rick Wakeman informs us, is a long, long time. Let me just say that no video gamer now living will survive long enough to experience the medium as an art form. So apparently we should all be dead already. According to Ebert, because we wouldn't have lived long enough to experience the medium as an art form. But here's a guy who, even though I don't think he's a particularly good film critic, is a popular film critic, and he's kind of weighing in on a medium that he doesn't particularly understand. And I think it's important to look at what exactly is he doing when he makes this statement. So he's in this kind of business of classification, right? He's in this business of saying, all right, well, we've got this subject called art. What can we say falls under that subset, and what does not? And so, you know, he says things like painting, sculpture, dance, opera, literature, film can all be classified as art, and that games are not. Probably some other things. I don't know where he stands on comic books. I don't think he's written about it yet, but I'm sure he can probably. I don't know what he thinks about pornography. Although since it's in film form, maybe he does think it's art. It's unclear. He hasn't weighed in on that yet. But the interesting thing about this is not new, right? This is like a high culture, low culture debate that's been going on for a really long time. And I think it's particularly hilarious because he reviews films. And films had to fight out of the low culture phenomenon to gain respect as a high culture medium, right? And so he's working, reviewing a medium that was once conceived as low culture, had to work really hard to be considered high culture, and now he's saying, look, my films are high culture, your video games are low culture. Which is totally hilarious because, you know, in the past 50 years, this has been completely collapsed by postmodernism, right? But that's a whole other talk altogether, right? Like maybe high culture and low culture don't even exist anymore. So Ebert brings this all back and he gets everybody upset, and a bunch of trolls are on his website saying really terrible things about him and about what he said, but he kind of reinvigorated this talk. And so New Scientist, inspired by this Ebert controversy and looking for content on Culture Lab, asked the question, can games be art? And they sent it out to a bunch of game scholars saying, what is your opinion on this? And Ian Bogost is a very smart guy and says, you know, some really interesting things. This is really long. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But in the first paragraph, you know, he brings up things like Fountain by Marcel Duchamp, which is, you know, a urinal in a museum, for those of you who don't know about it. And that was, you know, that was a statement, a piece of art that he was literally trying to confront what high culture defines as art by taking literally a urinal, putting it upside down on art and titling it Fountain, upside down on a pedestal and titling it Fountain, and putting it in a museum, which is the pinnacle of high culture, right? If you can make it in a museum, your art. And so, you know, this is something that, you know, that he did. He mentions Yoko Ono's performance art, where she's sitting in a chair and she has scissors next to her, and the audience is invited to come cut her clothes off one piece at a time. you know, a lot of this kind of stuff, you know, Andy Warhol pop culture paintings, you know, Mondrian's kind of, you know, abstract paintings. And you know, he says a lot in that first paragraph, but I think this interesting part that I sort of pseudo-highlighted down here is interesting, starting in the middle. He says, if the purpose of art is indeed to force us to see something we thought we understood in a new light, perhaps the most fundamental move video games have made in the artistic tradition is in the very eliciting of the question, can video games be art? I think that's really interesting, right? So the fact that people are even asking this question suggests that video games are doing something that art, we traditionally conceive of art doing. And so that's, you know, that's, I think, a really kind of powerful statement, that we're even having this discussion. It kind of renders the question moot in some senses, which is, you know, kind of, I would say, classic Bogostian wordplay. I think I just made something up called Bogostian. I should tweet it with that. So John Sharp from the Savannah College of Art Design has had a lot of kind of thoughts on this. He's actually a great person to talk about this because he studies video games, but he does it from an art history background as well, right? And that's particularly useful. You know, he talks about some interesting things here. He talks about, you know, similarly to what Ian was doing, he's talking a bit about how, you know, video games and art are kind of doing some similar things at times, and yet games, you know, have certain affordances that other media do not. So he says at the end here, which I think is interesting, all this poses the question of why are we concerned with giving video games the status of art? This is one of the reasons why I hate this question. Are we simply trying to legitimize them? Does being called quote-unquote art change the qualities of video games? Only if we can answer these questions can we move the conversation forward. And I think he's reacting here to the question itself. Actually, he and Ian both are kind of reacting to the question. Ian's saying the question invalidates itself, and John Sharp now saying that this question, it's not helping us. Asking, you know, how does calling it art, what does that do for the medium? That's the important question, right? And so here's some thoughts about the question and some kind of more evidence for why I think the question, are video games art, is just, it's a fine problem. Mary Flanagan sort of takes it as being assumed that video games are art, which I think is actually great. In Critical Play, she doesn't go to great lengths to define video games as art. She just looks at art, and she looks at games and compares them. And she just kind of assumes that this is so. And I think this is a really nice quote from really the beginning of her Critical Play book, where she says, Critical Play is built on the premise that, as with other media, games carry beliefs within their representation systems and mechanics. This is really important. Artists using games as a medium of expression, again, good use of italics, then manipulate elements common to games, representation systems and styles, rules of progress, codes of conduct, context of perception, winning and losing paradigms, ways of interacting in a game, for they are the material properties of game, much like marble and chisel or pen and ink bring with them their own intended possibilities, limitations, and conventions. It's a great point. You would have a really hard time making a painting with a chisel and no paint, right? Like if you were using marble and a chisel and you were trying to make a painting, right? Two different things, both are art. It's the same thing with games, right? Games have rule sets, games have systems, games have, you know, win and loss paradigms. They have all these things that are kind of conventions and things that we associate with even our definition of what a game is, which is at times faulty. But those are our tools. Those are how we communicate things. And I think her first sentence is really important. And I'm guessing with the stuff that you've been talking about with them and Gonzalo Frasca, you know, that's kind of coming through. And I actually see that in your games, right? You're trying to. So for example, I play tested that FedEx game, and I play tested a game about marriage, right? And there's all kinds of meaning in those systems and meanings in those choices that you get. That are being communicated, and that's very similar to what an artist would do with any other medium, right? You're communicating a message through those, and sometimes we do it accidentally. It's not always explicit, right? It's like we make something. I always say that the graveyard and when you get divorced and you put your divorced person in the graveyard was an interesting choice for me because it was creating an equivalence between divorce and death, which I think is kind of interesting. So that's just, you know, kind of one interesting example. So Mary Flanagan in her book talks about this art movement called Fluxus. Before I go on, any kind of thoughts or questions? Does anybody think video games aren't art still? Or it's okay. Oh crap! I'm gonna fight. No.
Totally different. Like when we were designing art, so our project now is you have to choose a real world system and emulate it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're all working on.
Yeah.
And one of the big things like that really helped us get started was like, what is the message we want to get across to each of the evolutions? What is it about evolution? Do you want to say that it's random? Do you want to say that it's this? And how do we express that?
Yeah.
How we got into it?
Yeah. No. Totally. And it gets even crazier when you take when you try to look at systems that are not particularly tangible, right? So, you know, you maybe have looked at it, but, you know, Elude is a game about depression, right? Like, there aren't exactly tangible kind of roadmaps the way there are with, like, FedEx systems for clinical depression, right? And yet, if you're looking at things like emotions, feelings, stuff like that, we might call abstract or just not immediate, how do you communicate those in systems, right? It's really tricky.
Sure. I find this tougher argument for games, which are like more games mechanics or more abstract. So, Zynga Poker Art.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question.
What do you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, and I think that falls along the same lines as, like, you know, like I said, I mean, does Ebert consider pornography art? I mean, it's like a really difficult question, and that's such a much kind of a much larger kind of art history debate, right? About has high culture and low culture completely collapsed? Has mass media proliferation, like, deteriorated conceptions of what, you know, really high culture art are versus low culture? And I think that's I don't have particularly good answers for that. You know, I think just as all of the other media that we look at, like, does a Jerry Bruckheimer film count as art, right? Just like we would look at that and ask that question, we don't then, you know, deny the entire medium of film from the possibility of being artistic. There seems to be this desire, because the majority of games in our sector, which I actually completely disagree with too, because if you go far back, they're most, I should say, video games, but because most video games are kind of commercially intended and involve, you know, fairly similar themes, right, does that, you know, preclude the medium from the possibility of being artistic? You know, and I go back to that Ebert kind of comment about, like, you know, he says they can't possibly be, or at least, you know, he says never is a long time, but not in our lifetime, apparently, is it possible. So, no, it's a good point. A good question.
So there's actually an interesting effects with us, the game that we're designing, which is essentially, like, city building and city creation in the time of, like, the Roman Empire. And we actually didn't intend to, like, instill any meaning in the game. But once we actually designed the mechanics and stuff, we realized that it was essentially a game about the rich getting richer and trying to control the poor. So it's like there's almost this, like, inherent meaning that came out from just designing the game.
Yeah, yeah, and you almost can't help, right?
Yeah.
But have it happen in some instances. It reminds me of a good thing that Brenda Brathwaite put in one of her talks once, which was about the game Civilization, the mod Colonization for Civ 4, which is a great mod in which you play one of the European colonizers and you come over to the New World, and you know, there's indigenous peoples there, and you have to kind of negotiate with them at first, but eventually they just kind of you either beat them up and take their land, or they just give it to you because you're more powerful than they are. And she was making the point, you know, there's this great box art with, like, the Native Americans in the corners and, like, the conquistador in the middle, you know, the Spanish and the Dutch. And it's like, if you were a Native American, how would you respond to this game, right? I mean, it's like, I'm like, yeah, I'm totally making America again, you know? And other people would be like, oh, my God, you basically just, you know, wiped out my ancestors, thanks. So it's true. I mean, sometimes you fall into meaning. It's something that does. And I think, you know, again, a lot of art does that, right? And some art did it quite purposely, you know, where they weren't divulging the meaning, they were inviting readings of it. So Fluxus. Fluxus is this this really interesting mid-20th century art. They rejected the term movement. They called it an attitude. That Mary Flanagan talks about a bit in her critical playbook, and it's actually quite interesting. It really starts out early with John Cage. Have you guys heard of him, the composer? He's most famous for this piece of music that he wrote where, I forget the duration, it's like
4:33,
yeah. It's four minutes and 33 seconds of not playing, right?
Rests.
Like, yeah, he rests, exactly. So you'd sit down at the piano and you'd pull out the music and everyone would hush, and then for 4 minutes and 33 seconds you'd sit there, possibly with your hands on the keys, and then after the time you would stand up, you'd take a bow, the audience would erupt into, you know, incredible applause. But he was really kind of testing the idea of what they eventually kind of called scores or event scores, right? This idea that, like, music, music is an art form where you can kind of write it down, and then it becomes performable, right? It becomes this kind of thing that someone can engage with, and we don't think of paintings that way. We don't think of paintings as having a score, having some kind of, you know, how do I engage with this, right? It sounds kind of like games. They're in, you know, figuring out how does interactivity work in artistic mediums. Really interested in indeterminacy, too. I mean, I think you'll see in some of these examples that they're really kind of pushing on the boundaries of what art has been doing to this point. They call it intermedia, meaning that the more kind of multiple modes that you can use for communicating it was really important to the attitude. Simplicity was really big, right? Having kind of basic systems and basic kind of scores, and then this idea of play was really kind of important. Yoko Ono, it's funny, you know, we sort of just attach her to John Lennon, but she was an artist before she was, just in a relationship with him, and she's actually kind of well known as one of these kind of Fluxus practitioners. This is interesting. This is the Fluxus Manifesto. I kind of wanted to just put this up because I think you can get a little bit of a sense for what they were trying to go for. So, they were taking the word fluxus and or flux and, you know, putting a definition, but then they were kind of amending it here. So, you know, purge the world of bourgeois sickness, intellectual, professional, and commercialized culture. Purge the world of dead art, imitation, artificial art, abstract art, illusionistic art, mathematical art. I like this. Purge the world of Europeanism. Don't even know if that'll work. Yeah, promote a revolutionary flood and tide in art. Promote living art, anti-art, non-art reality. I mean, these things sound like totally crazy, right? I love the to be fully grasped, but then it crosses out fully, right? And I don't doubt that was completely intentional. Or if they wrote fully grasped, they're like, oh, this is going to be great, right? I'm crossing out so you can see that I crossed out fully grasped. We want it to be not fully grasped, you know? We want it to be partially grasped by all people. Not only critics, dilettantes, and professionals. So, and it's just a really interesting thing, and this sort of like screams kind of the avant-garde, right? They're trying to like push against boundaries. They're trying to figure out what is the edge of the medium, and then how can we just like, you know, jump way off it. And some of the classic Fluxus works were these things called flux boxes or flux kits. And flux kits tended to have event scores. This is one of the most famous, called Water Yam by George Brecht. And basically, this is a box with 70 event scores. And these are an example of kind of event scores. And it's interesting. I mean, event scores really seem like rule systems, right? Like they're like the instructions to your board game. Except they're kind of wacky. I mean, if you look at air conditioning, the rule is move through the place, which is really interesting. I mean, if you encounter this game and you're like, all right, I'm going to play Water Yam, and then you pull out air conditioning, and you're like, move through the place. And I think that's kind of, you know, pretty characteristic of the movement, right? Present you with some sort of objective or some sort of requirement, but one that is kind of abstract or nebulous or just, you know, kind of strange. This one's even better. On a white chair, a great tape measure, alphabet, flag, black, and spectral colors. In this instance, it's not even clear what you're necessarily supposed to do. Are you supposed to compile these things on a white chair? Are you supposed to sit on a white chair and hold all of these things? It's not particularly clear. And this is the playfulness of this movement. This is kind of the energy of this kind of avant-garde movement. You can see kind of the relationship, I hope, between kind of rule systems and these. The next example is, I think, a better one, but you can see how they're kind of playing around with these ideas. At least they're incorporating interactivity into these art pieces, right? And keep in mind, these are being shown in galleries. These are being shown in high art places, right? These are being sent out to their friends as works of art. This one's great. This is White Chess by Yoko Ono. And it's often kind of depicted on its own, and you have to imagine what the rules are. But I actually think her rules as they are written are actually pretty important to it. So she says, play it for as long as you can remember who is your opponent and who is your own self. Very interesting wordage. But so what are the complications with white chess? Anyone? Any thoughts? Based on your perceptions of non-white chess or white and black chess.
Yeah, we need to argue, but... That was high quality or fun.
Yes, you definitely, it will be hard to keep track of, I would think. Yeah, I mean, that's why she said, as long as you can remember. Any other kind of weirdness from this?
Who's friend and who's enemy?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, right? I mean, this is sort of like, wait, was that my piece, was that your piece? And not only does that complicate your relationship to the other player, right, but now it's like to the game itself. It's like, wait, what was the strategy I was doing?
You might friendly fire.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to keep track of stuff in chess. What about the board?
You might swap the king and the queen by mistake because you don't have...
There's not really any, like, actual boxes on the board.
They're all white, right? So I mean that sort of complicates things a little bit too, right? Because you need to kind of remember
how large is
how you're moving. This one's really big. This is like a garden installment of white chess. And I think the cool thing too, I mean this is another example of kind of the movement, right? As long as you have the components, you could play this game. You could create this art piece. I think for Yoko Ono, the sense is not go play my installation of white chess. It's that this is the rules. These are the pieces. It can be played, and that screams game, right? I mean, that screams that kind of portability of a game. But again, you know, this wasn't considered anything but art, except probably by people who you know turned their nose at this sort of thing anyway. So, any thoughts on? Any thoughts on what white chess could be, you know, kind of about in a
two different sides merging to become one, and so eventually get why am I fighting? Who is my enemy in this situation?
Sure. The other thoughts? Yep.
Racial relations.
Sure. Racial relations.
I mean, there's probably like a whole anti-war thing of like, you know, are we actually destroying ourselves?
Yeah, and I mean that's an interesting thing. Yoko Ono was a decidedly kind of anti-war activist in the time that she was making this in the early 60s. I mean, one thing that you can't take anything for granted: the pieces aren't all black, right? They're all white. So I think the race thing does kind of play a factor. The inability to remember who you're attacking and who you are. Even I think that's actually why I really like her words, because for as long as you can remember who is your opponent and who is your own self, there's something about incorporating your own self in there, not just saying who, you know, what your pieces are, right? She's not saying can you remember what your pieces are. She's saying, you know, remember who you're playing against versus who you are. That's very different verbiage, and so I think it's very much a game about who are you fighting anyway? You know, what is the point of war? What is the purpose of war? And how does war particularly function? And in the rhetoric of the time, it makes a lot of sense, right? So that's Yoko Ono's White Chess, which is part of the Fluxus movement.
That's awesome.
It's pretty cool. And actually, Fluxus and artists in this period have a really interesting relationship with chess. There's like some quote, and I'm going to butcher it, but it was I think it was Marcel Duchamp saying that not all chess players are artists, but all artists are chess players, or something like that. He was particularly fascinated with chess, and you can see elements of chess in his work, you know, either being, you know, painted or whatever, and so.
He was completely obsessed with chess.
Yeah.
He played it really hard. He wasn't necessarily a very good player.
But
he played a lot.
Very into it. So now I'm going to kind of move out of this sort of Fluxus movement. I just wanted to show you a couple examples, but I think this next one is actually sort of an interesting, this is a current game that I'm really excited about, which is called 16 Tons. And this is a game I unfortunately have not been able to play yet, but I've witnessed play, because it's a game for four players. But this was created by Eric Zimmerman and Natalie Pazzi. And it's a really interesting game. It's a little hard to see from these pictures, but it's this giant circle, I would say, almost the size of this room, of corrugated cardboard. Maybe even bigger, a little bit bigger than this room. But inside you've got this kind of array of colored circles, and these pretty hefty steel tubes that have color. Let's go through the rules. I mean, the first thing to notice is that they contextualize the title 16 Tons with a quote from the song, "We load 16 tons, and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt." So this is doing an interesting thing that actually, you know, John Sharp, who you can actually see in the middle, thinks is actually particularly important for games and games that are kind of working this art movement, is that they declare their intentionality. Whether they declare what their meaning is or not is less important, but they to be taken seriously, you need to take yourself seriously, I think was one of the things he said. And I think, you know, this is another great example. You can talk about how other games, maybe in the digital space, do this, but right now they're already kind of priming you for reading the rules in a way that is different than just, ooh, let's play. Right? I mean, could you imagine if Monopoly had some sort of, you know, like Marxist quote in the front of it or something like that, right? Your experience of it would be completely different. So you set up, you put the pieces kind of in this array, you stand on a number, and that indicates what color you are, and this is great. You take out $3, although you can see in the second picture they're playing what Eric, the designer, has deemed high stakes, 16 tons, where you pull out $3 $5 bills. And so it says, how to win. You win when the two pieces of your color are directly adjacent to each other. So diagonally adjacent does not count for a win. The way you play is players take turns starting with player one. When it's your turn, you say, put me to work. Players may then offer to pay you one or more dollars in any order. So anyone can just say, I'll give you this. You have to accept the highest payment, except if there's a tie, right? Because with, you know, with specific denominations, there's very likely to be a tie. Then you get to choose which of the highest bidders you can take. And the person who pays then tells you what move to make. And if no one offers to pay you, you get to decide what to do. And then it's the next player's turn, and you continue until one player wins. Just off the top of your heads, having not even played it, it's tough to critique games when you haven't played, but just looking at the rules and hearing about it, and even kind of, I love that picture on the left because it embodies some of the kind of spirit of the play too, but what are some interesting things about this rule set that you notice?
You play with money, but you don't win money.
Well, that's an interesting question. What happens to the money at the end of the game?
Who knows? Do you keep it?
That's unclear.
Very unclear. And that's one of the things that's really great about this game, right, is that it puts you into these social situations where now you're playing with real currency that was your own, and now it's like, well, what happens to this, right? And so it says you win if your pieces, but maybe you feel like you win if you move the most pieces and you have the most money at the end of the game, right? I mean, you've got this kind of weird economy in here. And I think the fact that it's not explicit in this rule set is great, right? I mean, that's what creates this sort of potential for kind of an interesting social dynamic. Other things that are interesting about this game.
If you're the only person who has money, then you basically win.
You can basically win if you're the only person who has money, yeah. So it does require a little bit of strategy, too.
Technically, from that setup, could you win on the first turn? Because it seems you only have, do you have only two pieces of a certain color?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but up on the right is assume the starting position.
Yeah, I know. And so, so on your turn, you could take one piece, your piece, and have it be moved to the square right next to yours.
No,
you go move
to any
adjacent. Oh, you have to move it.
Read the rules on the right there.
Oh, so any adjacent. Oh, any adjacent. No.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't read the adjacent.
Yeah. It's any adjacent or empty square.
That's actually really interesting.
Yeah, it's a really weird. I mean, I also think the the agency you have in the game to win is not by moving your own pieces, it's by paying someone to do the work for you, right? And so then we kind of get back to this quote at the beginning, you go to 16 tons and what do you get, another day older and deeper debt. It's like, what is this game about? I mean, it could be about a lot of things, and I mean, we honestly probably shouldn't dissect it until we've played it. I think too, the kind of corrugated cardboard, it gets hot inside of there if you're not outside, and that's a really interesting thing too, right? Like, you're in there, it's hot, it's sweaty, you've got dirty money in your hands, you're moving around these fairly, you know, sizable, they have weight to them. That was really important too, right? I mean, this could have been played around a table with, you know, go pieces or something, you know, painted go pieces, but these are like, you know, these are substantial steel pieces that you've got to pick up and move. And you know, obviously the song was about kind of manual labor. So this is a really interesting game. This was released at the Art History of Games Conference last year, and it did well at Indiecade this year. It won the Developers' Choice Award, and it's really cool. I want to try to get it up to MIT so that we can all play it.
It occurs to me that you could, if you play by rules where you keep the money you get at the end of the game, you basically could throw the game to get all the money.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you could try, right? But you know, people are going to know what you're doing, you know, and people are going to see your strategy. So it's
not going to pay you, Jack.
Yeah, I mean, the game gets in. So I mean, again, like, just kind of cycling back to what we're talking about. I mean, is this art? Well, you know, it would be hard for me to call it much of anything else. So this is like one of my favorite games. It's certainly my favorite. It's Jason Mermaid. Who's played Gravitation here? A couple of you? All right, cool. And a bunch of you haven't. That's awesome. So I'll get one of you to play it. One thing I want to point out with this, I mean, we can talk after someone's played Gravitation a little bit about you know, what we think about the game itself, but I think this quote is interesting. You know, he has artist statements with all of his games. Some of them say more, some of them say less. This one responded because this was after Passage was released, and I think you guys have all seen Passage, right? And you can immediately identify the aesthetic similarities because the character is exactly the same. And he was responding to criticism from people about his pixel art. And why did he go for pixel art? But he says, I now see ultra-low-res pixel art as a kind of digital cartooning. It stands right on the line between the symbolic and the representational, leaving plenty of room for viewer interpretation. Why draw sideburns when the viewers can imagine sideburns on their own? You just need to give them something to pin their imagination on, something to guide them a bit. Cartoons are perfect for that. And I think that's a really interesting point. And I think what he's also suggesting here, which is maybe not clear, is that this is doing a similar thing to what that quote from the music does. It's priming your experience of the play, right? You load up this game, you see that it's got this low-res pixel art that we now associate with this kind of art game movement, and you're ready to read this in another way. If I gave you a first-person shooter and told you nothing about it except that it was going to be the fastest, awesomest multiplayer first-person shooter experience, but it looked like this, would you be inclined to read it like an art game? I mean, I don't know, but certainly in this instance with these kind of little games, right, this sort of pixel art aesthetic that you see being duplicated in a lot of places is sort of kind of priming the pump. It's establishing some sort of context in which you can read this game. So who wants to play Gravitation, actually? That's not what was supposed to happen. I wanted to click on the link. Oh, because I clicked on my screen, not this screen. And all it does is take me out of here.
Yeah.
Not being mirrored might be a problem. Let's see. Let's see what screen this loads up on. Both. One. Crap. Okay, hold on one sec. I gotta mirror my screen. I should not be choosing who plays. Who wants to? I can't make the choice. Who wants to do it?
Interesting that it's a version 0.
Yeah,
I should explicitly make that the case.
Anybody, it's free to download. So if you don't play it now, you can play it on your own.
We have a few games, right? So
what's that?
We have a few games, right? So
oh yeah, we have a few. So yeah, we have a few different opportunities to play. So anybody, jump over and play.
Yeah, we'll start with Jason, and then we'll do kind of jump in.
And actually, if you wouldn't mind talking about your experience of playing Gravitation as you play it, like let's play, but the live
Gravitation. Okay. Oh, I seem to have a very strict view, and it's falling. It is falling.
Oh, wait.
I caught it.
Oh, actually, I know. Oh, never mind.
She stole your ball.
Oh, she plays with you.
She stole it.
She seemed to like you, but she stole it for a little bit. But now she seems to be playing, which is better.
Yes.
How are you?
We seem to be bouncing it back and forth, and my screen gets bigger whenever I successfully do so. And it's getting harder and getting lower. Aww.
It gets bigger when she loves you.
The screen's a fiery thing. She seems to be bouncing the ball more.
Yay.
Put it up there.
What happens when he goes to
star?
You're on the fire.
It isn't fire.
You're on the
I'm on fire. This seems bad.
He's on fire!
I'm really confused.
You should go to the furnace.
He likes on fire.
Oh, now you're not on fire. That makes sense.
Whoa!
Wait, can you bounce the ball up there?
I didn't see any people jump high enough to get up there. Oh, there we go.
Not always the case.
Whoa!
You just jump high every time. What's that star?
A star! Or wall jump.
Uh oh. Well, now you can bounce the ball.
You can jump higher when she loves you.
The size of the screen.
Yeah. It dictates how high you can jump. Okay, so I guess we'll bounce it more so that I can jump higher.
Oh, it's grab. Oh.
You're just using her.
I'm on fire again.
How could you?
Oh, but you're not gonna fight the clock. She's not gonna love you very soon. Yeah!
Oh, apparently,
stars
is also good.
At least not
so. She presumably loves me when I
start. Oh, no.
Yeah, but the screen closes faster and faster the higher up you get, I think.
Yeah.
Weird.
Or maybe the more stars you eat.
And now it's all ice.
Oh, yes, because she was getting happier when I bounced the ball. I guess.
Is it
getting
cold? Oh my god.
Oh no.
Oh sure.
Oh, it's
nice.
Blocking the
is fire though?
I think it maybe pushed the stars into the fire so that they melt or something.
It's just
an arrow pointing.
Oh, now it's a star. Interesting.
What? Well, there's been a star there the entire time.
What?
Alright, go push more.
Yeah, there's
the fire.
A star with it.
I just didn't have a hammer.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're dead.
Because you're on fire.
The numbers on the stars are all going down. The ball can't get to you, it's so sad.
But now I can probably...
What?
Push the ice into the fire.
And the number on the top goes up every time you... Yeah, the numbers on the star correspond to how many, points you get on the top. Yep.
Being on fire seems like it would be bad.
Aww.
Sorry.
No!
Yeah!
I'm trying to get rid of the ice. Can we play later? Okay.
Wait, she doesn't want to play.
That's because I got rid of the ice and he was happy, I think.
Oh, it's getting icy though. It's getting colder.
There's no more stars to recharge my thing though.
I think you just have to go hard. This is where you were last time, I think. Yeah, there.
Get the star.
Whee!
Oh, well, that's really
high. If you get the stars too fast and your hair is burning, that means you're just getting too much love and it like starts falling really fast.
But there's more love.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
But there's a counter on the ice blocks of the stars, and you get more points if you get them into the furnace faster.
I think they went down when we started warming up in the furnace. So the warmer the world is, the less points you get for de-icing.
This is not global warming. Okay, so this
I think
is
about drugs. He gets love from this girl, and then, like,
right, the ice
I think
it's just the time
make him happy, but only for a little bit. Yeah.
What?
Yeah!
So if I'm on fire, it seems to reduce at a much faster rate.
Should avoid burning by not eating too many stars at a time.
Just pour out there. Just hit all.
I think it's about drugs.
It's like
I think everything's about drugs.
Crazy.
I mean, yeah, obviously.
I'm crazy as fuck.
You can actually catch the purple dragon in that game.
Oh, no!
No.
It's really stupid design. It's going all the way back down.
There's a column on the right where you can fall faster.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The higher you climb, the further you fall.
Ooh, poetic.
Now I probably don't have any stars. So I think we need to play...
She's gone!
She's dead! You killed her!
That's so sad! And there's not much fire left. And the fire isn't bringing things back.
Oh my god. You didn't get any stars for her, so she died.
Oh, that's so sad.
She eats stars!
Oh, there you go.
Wait, no,
there you go! Oh, is she there now? The fire started warming you again.
Chemotherapy.
No.
Nope. She's gone forever. You can't
ball.
Play ball alone.
When she's gone,
oh, you're gonna go
maybe
around.
She only comes in the spring. Maybe winter's too cold. So maybe if I wait by the fire.
Does it go fast?
She'll come back.
Yeah, what? Why is it getting bigger?
Because he's by the fire. It's getting warmer.
But that wasn't working earlier.
Now it is.
I don't think it goes faster.
You hit rock bottom.
Looks like it's spring.
But when she's
well, like,
she
going upward,
how high can you jump right now?
Can you hit the ball?
Pretty high. That's a lot of jumpos.
No, I can't hit the ball.
Only well, she can hit the ball.
Well, while you're increasing, you should probably go up. And
yeah, grab the stars.
Go up, go up.
Yeah, there you go.
And stop expanding.
Well, is it the stars?
Stop contracting, too.
Oh, you're even on
Whoa,
fire.
Oh, I'm on fire now.
He's on fire.
Can you go infinitely high if you're on fire?
Pretty darn high.
Uh-oh.
Whoa!
Stars.
Four stars?
Yeah. Are you getting all of them?
That might have been a bit of an overdose.
No!
Yeah, you totally OD'd on stars just there.
Because you can always hit stars as you go back
four,
down.
Or you can only hold four and then it retracts when you get four and then it turns ice blocks.
What?
That was intense.
It was a lot of falling.
Quick question, there were so much.
Oh, and she's still gone.
You only have five
seconds. And
the stick is free.
Hold
her.
You won! Yay!
Yeah, so
now, what you want is a good question.
That's gravitation, and actually, I mean, I'm not even kidding. That's certainly my favorite Jason Moore game. It's one of it's one of my favorite games, and I think even just the example of you guys playing is great, right? Because you're just kind of shouting out all these different ideas for what it could be about, you know, there's some clear intentionality in his design with this game, right? In terms of the system's trying to communicate something that's other than just, you know, engagement. Or I don't know, got fun. Was it fun?
Yeah.
Oh, all right, cool. yeah, it's pretty good. Thoughts on what it's about? I heard a couple people be like, drugs.
It's definitely drugs.
definitely drugs.
Tons of analogies, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like drugs.
Love is a drug.
Your relationship versus, like, whatever you're trying to do, your career, your... I call this like
cycles in life.
I think it's like the ultimate MIT game. If I told you that this was his daughter, would it change your interpretations of the game?
Oh, shit.
Yes.
Yeah. So now if you know that this is his daughter, what do you think it's about?
His job.
Neglect.
Work.
Neglect.
Job versus family, right? You know, he kind
Trust.
Of he says explicitly, like, before you play, that this is a game about motivation. And he doesn't go too far into telling you what the game is specifically about. And I think playing through it a couple times, but I mean, I will tell you, the first time I played and I came back out and she was gone, it was very upsetting for me. I was like, you know, and I don't know if it's just I was, you know, ready to play it that way or my life stage or something like that. But the idea of, you know, he's playing with his daughter that inspires him, you know, he travels. And then, you know, one of these days, if you're gone too long, she grows up. I mean, I don't know if she dies, but you know.
Well, you didn't bring her any money.
No, right, yeah.
She couldn't eat because she had no money.
Wanted new clothes, yeah.
She died.
So I think this is a really, really kind of interesting game. And
it's a game about motivation.
It is, yeah.
She OD'd on drugs.
So it's free. If you just Google search Gravitation, Jason Roar, you'll find the links to it. You'll find his artist statement, which I think is really kind of good to read. Again, with John Sharp's kind of point about, like, you know, declaring your intentionality, whether you say what the game's about, is important. I think this qualifies, at least for me, as art. It's doing things that I see other pieces of art doing. Okay, so Paolo Pedersini, how many over time? Oh, I'm good. Paolo Pedersini is one of my favorite game designers right now, and this game actually is one of his newest ones, and I think it's hilarious and great. And it's called Memory Reloaded: The Downfall. Test your concentration with Memory Reloaded, a matching game for these unstable times. History may be different from that which you remember. And who would like to play Memory Reloaded? I'm laughing already because it's funny. Has anybody played it? I need somebody who's not played it. Okay, good. Jeremy, you want to do it?
Sure.
Awesome. Okay. You're up. Hold on.
Right. I will click.
Don't do it.
Oh, you're on.
You're done.
You lost already.
No way. That's kind of scary. All right. Oh, I can already see what they can do.
Yeah.
They're gonna play the down switch on me. All right. Afghan freedom fighter. He's gonna be a terrorist later. Migrant workforce.
Yay.
Iraqi oil. Afghan freedom fighter.
I bet if you grab Iraqi oil before Afghan freedom fighter, he becomes a terrorist.
Global inequality. Peace and
global inequality.
Global inequality.
Global inequality.
Yes.
Yes.
All that. Global inequality. Yes. All right.
Really
fighting. I'm doing well. Ruthless Maker. Loan Shark. Iraqi. Was Iraqi oil here?
Yeah.
No.
Oh,
Iraqi.
Snap.
No.
Oh. Wait.
Awkward. All right. Universal healthcare. Man-made global warming. Natural climate. Hey, not cool. Universal healthcare. Yeah. Universal healthcare. Sweet. Oh.
One over there.
Yeah, there.
Nice.
Hooray.
Right under it.
Peace in Palestine. Well, natural financial advantage. Come on. Wait. Why? Needy banker. Ruthless banker.
Oh, is the difference? Is the order you click them in?
Ruthless banker. What?
What are the other ones now?
It's yeah. Oh, there we go.
Yeah.
Nice. So that means now. Let's see. Hey.
You've never satisfied banker.
Yeah.
What the hell?
Oh dear. Did we? Shoot. Better move. Oh, I get it. That's fun. Is it the entire game?
Yes, that is the whole game. Of course, you can get different outcomes. But that's the idea. So I think you guys have seen some of Mullet Mestrina's other work, and you guys saw Every Day the Same Dream.
I like that.
Which is interesting. That one's also one of my favorite games. But this is kind of looking at another kind of sector of art, right? The kind of activist political statement sector of art, and doing that through games, and it's something that this music's going to emphasize. Something that he does particularly well with his games, and I think this one's particularly interesting and kind of funny. I love the kind of reworking of a really classic game mechanic, right? Like memory, the entire point of memory is your expectation that they would be the same the second time you turn it over. And when it changes on you, it reinforces that kind of perspective, I suppose, imbalance that can exist when you're not just turning over, you know, toadstools and Bowsers, but, you know, actual kind of interesting things. I really I love the crying, sweating polar bear. And the one with like a beach chair actually cracks me up. And I think humor is actually something that shouldn't be ignored here, right? I mean, if we remember, that was one of the kind of the central fluxus things, this idea of like satire. Humor is important. I think Paolo Pedersini's work is really awesome. And again, for me, it's certainly art enough. This game's really cool. Who's played Love? Do you have a few people who's played Love? All right, cool. I'd love someone who has not played Love to play it for a little bit. I don't know that we can play the whole game. This is actually a game that I really don't like, but I like the things that it does, if that makes any sense. Like, it bothers me for some reason, and yet, it's such an articulate statement, this game bothers me. But I think it's worth looking at because he's doing particularly interesting things. Alexander, I don't know, it's Osius? Akius? Osius? I suppose it's a soft C.
Osius?
Osius.
Osius.
Yeah. I think I have the sound for now. Sorry, top right.
No, you are a girl. Okay, I'm a girl.
If you say yes, will he like not teach you how to play? Wait, what's appearing?
What? I can't hit the red blocks now?
Do it.
You're just gonna have to go back to the part that was just hard.
See, he has no red blocks. You get red blocks when you disobey.
Yeah.
See, you still can't touch them.
So if you disobey, it hides from you what things actually are.
Which, you know, already we're in a position now where we're asking questions like that, which is, you know, if you were playing Modern Warfare 2, you might say, what's the point? And, like, would be to blow a lot of stuff up, right? So, this is a response he had in one of his interviews he gave after it was released. He said, I wanted to get people to wake up and think about the games they are playing. Much of the industry appears to be pushing in the opposite direction. SA-LOM tutorials, holding your hand from beginning to end in subtext, screamed through pointless exposition. It is treating players like idiots. It's absolutely infuriating. When you think about it in terms of the tutorial, right, if this is the tutorial for playing the game, it's pretty obnoxious. But it's not that much different than the kind of tutorials that we encounter in a lot of games, right, that just basically hold your hand and tell you how to do everything. So I think he's really kind of confronting that. I guess if I were to say the reasons that I don't like this game, I think the control scheme is actually, it's a weakness. The game is so hard that... I mean, you saw, like, you know, you couldn't even get to the things that he was trying to communicate. It gets weirder the farther along you get, I can promise you. It's just, it's like you have to get really skilled at doing it. So there's kind of like a play barrier for entry on it. It also, for me, I think, dare I say, it almost gets like too abstract for me at certain points where it's clear that he's trying to say something, but there's nothing I can latch onto to understand what it is, and it's entirely his prerogative. But for me, that's, I'm just like, what? Like, I have no clue what this is about at all. So that's a little tricky.
You're not fully grasping.
I'm partially. So yeah, it's like the perfect Fluxus piece of art. So. Okay, so I've only got a couple more to talk about, and I've got about 15 minutes. This, I think, is actually one of the most important games that we can talk about today, which is Cowclicker. Who's played Cowclicker? Yay! This is by Ian Bogos, the guy we saw earlier. And he said, Cowclicker is a Facebook game about Facebook games. It's partly a satire and partly a playable theory of today's social games and partly an earnest example of that genre. So this is kind of like a classic sort of art thing to do, right? You take something that you're going to satire and you make a version of that that maybe does some things differently, but is fundamentally what you are satiring. It's like the Andy Kaufman comedic kind of style, right? Where you just assume that kind of character or role, and it's something that I think is like kind of like joyfully subversive in doing satire. So hopefully I'm logged into Facebook so you can see. And I haven't clicked recently, so you guys can witness one of my clicks. Am I connected? Yeah. Facebook is down. Facebook is canceled forever.
Yes!
Dasher has no friends.
It's also possible that the wireless in this in that corner is kind of bad.
Should I switch to Google Guest? So I can actually kind of, before we even see it, I can talk a little bit about the sort of interesting controversy that CalClicker is creating. It's making money.
You have
internet? MacBook Airs don't have internet.
Oh.
Let me try Google Guest.
Yeah.
I'm not connected. How about now? It seems to be working better.
Give it a second. You're still not.
It takes a little while to get into
IP. So the last part of his statements about an earnest effort at a game, it is fundamentally a Facebook game. So you can see I've got five Mooney. My next click is in a minute and 40. Oh man, I missed one of my clicks. But maybe if we wait while I talk about it, you can witness one of my clicks. I actually have some clicks left. I've got one this week. But
that's in 2 hours.
Yeah, it looks like that's when I get my next one. So basically, you can click your cow, which why can I not click my cow here? Well, you can click your cow, and then you can... Oh, it's because I'm on scrolling? I don't know. Anyway, you can click your cow, and then you can use your Mooney to buy new cows that are fundamentally the same thing as other cows, just with aesthetic differences. So, plain cow. These are the cows I have. I have a plain cow and a steel cow. I haven't been playing a lot of Cow Clicker. If I go to buy a cow, I could buy a new cow. So you can see lots of different cows that cost you in-game currency.
Paisley cow.
Yep. Holy cow. oil cow got retired. Oh. Sad. It's got a BP logo. It's cute.
DT.
Like the SD cows. Yeah, that's pretty good. So there's lots of different cows, and you can buy cows. You can give cows. You can invite a cow. There's cow rankings.
Invite a cow.
you can see, Mooney is actually pretty inflated at this point. You can get 10 Mooney for 50 cents, which is pretty great, 1,000 for $10, which is kind of awesome. Collect a lot of cows, and you can trade cows, and you can go to your friends' barns and see how many cows they have, and you can click on your cows when you make your appointment to actually click on your cows. I think you can see how he's poking fun at things like Farmville, things like Ravenwood Fair, which I'm obsessed with now, actually. These kind of games where all you're fundamentally doing is clicking and acquiring an in-game currency that you can then use for in-game goods. But then, of course, you reach this barrier where you don't have enough in-game currency and you need to use real currency. Of course, the interesting thing is, like, there are, like, I don't know, 500,000 people playing this, or I don't know if it's that many. It's a lot. Here, if we go to the Cow Clicker front page, right, it'll tell us. Oh, Joe Soltero was at St. Bartholomew's Church. Where does it say how many players there are?
Ranking.
Maybe in rankings, yeah.
I did that on Board News.
Who's milking the cow clicker? You can see this person's Monica's.
He has no countdown.
Oh. Maybe he said.
Is it their all-time clicks or this week click?
Is there like a? Oh, yeah.
Here we go.
Twelve thousand
monthly active users. Yes, 500,000 is a bit of a stretch, but. But that's a lot of people, and he's making some interesting money on it. And I think one of the things that was important that he did is there's kind of an active forum where people can kind of talk about it. So it is a little bit weirdly controversial, right? Because he made this game that is, poking fun at Facebook games, and yet it is a Facebook game. And it's, presumably making some money, too. So But I think it's really good. I think it's, you know, this is the kind of art that's also important, where it's like taking what we do and purposely looking at how is it constructed and how is it set up, and satiring it and forcing us to kind of be introspective about the things that we do and the way that we engage. And so this is a kind of subversive game design that I think, you know, along the lines of Paolo Pedersini's work and even Gonzalo Frasca, is kind of forcing us to look at how we interact. And CowClicker is really fun. So that's that one. And I've got like 15 minutes. Philip asked me to talk a little bit about some work that I'm doing in this space. So I'm going to talk to you about a game it's a work in progress. It's tentatively titled Before It Ends Now, and it's by me. And the idea from it is it's inspired a bit by Fluxus Boxes and those kind of Flux kits. I'm really interested in like physically tangible games. I don't know why I'm all of a sudden kind of obsessed with holding something, but I was at IndieCade and I heard again, and this is like the question that drives me more nuts than the our video games art question, although they're interestingly related. But it's, you know, when will we have the Citizen Kane of video games? It drives me absolutely nuts. I think 80% of the time the people who say that have never seen Citizen Kane, so they don't really know what that means. But I had heard it like for the umpteenth time at IndieCade, and I wanted to throw the television out of my hotel room window, and I was like, I was going nuts, and I was like, all right, well, what is Citizen Kane about? And I don't want to spoil it. Who's seen Citizen Kane in this room, actually? A handful of people? All right, good.
I don't mind you.
So I see Citizen Kane, and it's about this very kind of, you know, interesting idea about, you know, presence and mementos and happiness in a very kind of real way, and like the temporality of happiness, right? Like, are you happy now? Were you happy then? Do you remember being happy? When is happiness? And so I was like, well, I'm going to make a Citizen Kane of video games, but it's not going to be known for being epically innovative, you know, with camera movement. It's going to be about the things I think Citizen Kane are about. So it's basically, you know, in this form, although I'm rethinking what kind of box it's going to be in, but in this form it's a box. And inside of it are various objects that start out as the starting objects for the box are things that have personal significance to me. And one of the rules of the game, in fact, I think the most important rule of the game is this one. Rule number one, you may permanently exchange an object of personal significance for any object of equal value. So when you're playing this game, you can take something that belongs to you and you can exchange it for anything in the box. And then, of course, the interesting thing is these objects in the box are of varying degrees of interactivity, right? Like, you can do them in an Etch-a-Sketch, so you can draw something on the Etch-a-Sketch. You know, the rules are kind of veiled in this moment now, where there's like a couple other rules that, you know, are causing you to reflect. This is actually an extension of Yet One Word, which was a project we worked on in the summer, which was a game that, as you're playing, it's a platformer and you're typing, and the game stops and asks you personal questions. And what I really liked about that is it was doing something that I was kind of referring to as a mechanic of reflection, where the activity of play is reflecting, is thinking, is, you know, just contemplating. It's not interactive in a very kind of, you know, active way as we think of it. It's more reflective. I liken it to the moments in chess where you're planning your move. There's not a lot of action in chess. There's a lot of contemplation in chess. So if it's personal, you know, what if that were personal? And so what I particularly care about with Yet One Word is that it doesn't, it inspires you to reflect, but it doesn't do it with tremendous grace. It just asks you a question. It just comes out, you know, kind of out of the blue and says, hey, you know, when was the last time you lied? And if you, you know, sometimes you're surprised by that, and that's a good effect, but it's also not subtle. And so I'm trying to explore how can we be subtle in causing reflection. And so there are a few things here. I mean, the value question is interesting. How do you know what the value of the object is in the box? Do you think of it as a monetary value? Do you think of it as value in terms of significance to the person who put that in there? Why is it significant to the person who put that in there? Like, what is this thing, right? You can look at it and reflect. And then when you leave a trace of yourself in this box, the next person who comes and plays is going to see that. And they're going to wonder, what was that? And so I'm also kind of interested in, like, the organicness, the kind of, the never-ending, interminable nature of a game that carries the effect of a person who's played it kind of on and on and on. The next iteration of this that I want to do, actually this was an idea that Jason Bean gave me, was to use an apothecary chest. Because one of the things that we playtested it here with, I left it out for like 2 weeks, and people, you probably saw it was right there, people were engaging in. This is actually, this is like a photo with objects that people had left in. So it was really fun for me after 2 weeks to kind of go into this box and be like, what is all this stuff? You know, like what got left? I was actually surprised the Etch-a-Sketch, was left, but I was like, wow, what is this stuff? And to give you one really good example, one person at the lab put in a Nintendo DS flashcard, which was really like a wrapped DS flashcard. And so now there's this kind of next level. The game has changed with another level of interactivity where it's like, if I want to kind of get at what was the significance of this object to this person, I need to get a DS and play this, right? And so then I open up the DS, and it's got folders, and it's got a copy of the game Lemmings. It's got some music in it, right? And so now it's kind of like you've uncovered this next layer, and it's like the interesting traces of the people who have played this game are now marked onto this box forever. Marley even said to me, I was like, talking to her about her play after she'd done it, and I was like, she told me she wanted to take the instructions. She wanted to take the rules as one of the objects that she could take out of that. And I told her, I had thought about that actually when I was designing it, that someone might be like, ha, I'm going to take the rules. And I was going to put in a rule that said, you can permanently exchange for an object. That's not the rule, so that the game could persist. But I didn't want to artificially impose that. If someone takes the rules because that's what they want, now the game has changed. And maybe someone comes along later and modifies it. Maybe they put something in that makes it a whole new different game. And I really like the idea that you can encounter this game and that it's going to be kind of in this state of flux, I guess you could say. And so that's what I'm working on now. Like I said, I think one of the things I didn't like is that all of the objects are accessible all at once. So if it's an apothecary chest with lots of drawers, this was Jason Bean's idea, then you kind of have to do a little exploring. And maybe the rules are in one of those drawers, and maybe you see the rules first, maybe you see the rules way after you've looked at a lot of stuff. And then now you've seen all this stuff and played with it all, and you really like something, and now it's like, ooh, what do I trade? I also am trying to find a way to give the box a history as well. I've contemplated some ideas of putting in some kind of clues that you could then, if you thought about it or looked it up, you might be able to find a story to this box. Like if you did an internet search, you might come upon a fake website. Well, it wouldn't be fake, it'd just be a website. But a website with a fake story that kind of tells you a little bit about this box and maybe gives you a few more hooks into what the meaning of this game or what the inspiration for this game was. And so this is kind of one of my projects that I'm working on right now. Like I said, I'm interested in tangibility, but you can see where a lot of the other things that I was talking about are kind of inspiring this work. And so we kind of come back to that question of are games art and whether it's even a valid question. We only have 5 minutes. I don't know if you guys have administrative stuff afterwards, but this is, like I said, this is sort of my viewpoint. And it's certainly shared with a lot of other people. But it's not. This is not guaranteed truth. This is an opinion that I have just shared. So, but any thoughts you guys have about this subject or these ideas of these games or anything at all? Yesterday's football game.
Jets won.
They did. Well, cool. Well, I hope this was useful. I hope it was helpful. I think if at the very least it causes you to continue to think about, your own games that you're developing and how meaning can be embedded in the play that you might not even realize is there. But also just kind of the possibility space. I really am excited by, I'm discouraged by the safe choices that a lot of independent game developers make and excited when some game developers really push on the edge. I don't think we have a clear understanding of what the rules are or what even constitutes a game or what degree of interactivity is appropriate for a quote-unquote game. And I think some of these designers are really testing the waters of the medium. What can we really do with this? Where can we go? How edgy and satirical and avant-garde can we be? I think that's always good. Because I'm a revolutionary. Crazy person.
Crazy person.
Yeah, it's good to hear you.
folks, if folks haven't played yet, One Word is here, which were some of the games that Abe worked with the team on over the summer. Those are on our Gambit website. Just look under 2010, and you see Yet One Word is here, which were both developed this summer. We sort of like try to see some of the digital work.
And please play them and give us feedback too, right? Because that's the other thing. Like, these are not perfect articulations of game is the pure art form, right? Like, we're constantly evolving and trying to improve. And so any feedback you can give us on this stuff is greatly appreciated.
I have one question. Do you still have that box like somewhere?
Yeah, it's in my office. Yeah, totally. Yeah, I have a box, and I need to. I'm. So the other part of it is when I do the second version of it in the apothecary kind of chest. One thing that's important to me is that for the prototype, I just sort of threw some like reasonably meaningful objects in there. But I want it to be populated with objects that are personally significant to myself or symbolic to myself. And populating that box at the outset with meaningful objects, I think, is important because it's sort of once it's quote unquote released into the world for play, right? Then it's constantly changing, and so that first instantiation of the game is the one that is kind of about me in some sort of sense and about my experiences, and then it becomes the world, which is play.
So the way that your games kind of reminds me of is, I'm pretty sure I heard somewhere that some person had a pen, and so he started with a pen and he kept trading and made
a red paperclip.
Oh no, this is a different one, not the red paperclip for a car. I think it was someone had started with a pen or something and kept trading it, and over the course of like a year or two, he eventually from that initial pen, he was able to trade for a house or something.
No, totally. I mean, and that was like sort of an interesting. But I think it was on eBay too, right, or something like that. And that's even using a pretty well designed game system, because eBay is totally a game. And using a game system to subverting the system itself to do something really kind of interesting. And so that's a really kind of great. It's like a game inside of a game, right? And I love that. It's kind of like the cow clicker. It's right, like making a game inside of the game that subverts the system itself.
Are you familiar with the concept of geocaching? Because when I first saw the game you were talking about that you designed, it really reminded me of it. So initially what it was is when GPS first came out, people were like, oh, hey, this is really cool technology, we should think of something fun to do with it. So what they did was these people started hiding like empty tins of like little trinkets and stuff at various like on hiking trails or other locations, and you would look up the coordinates on your GPS finder and you would find this box, and what you would do, you trade a trinket and you get a trinket.
Oh, very
and
cool.
You keep like traveling to these other
places. And in that sense, like this whole worldwide game becomes kind of changed. Yeah, there's some shared ideas with some location-based games that do some really interesting things with that, where whether it's alternative reality, but maybe not even with a narrative. There was one I was reading about that was at Come Out and Play, I think, in New York City at one point. But it was Cruel to Be Kind, it was called. It was a game where you don't know who's playing, you know who's on what team, but you get missions and you get a weapon that's a compliment, like. To kill someone who's on the other team, mistake them for a celebrity or something like that, right? And so you're using these kind of random acts of kindness, helping someone across the street, and you don't know it's like in New York City, so you don't know if someone's playing the game, and so now all of a sudden you're kind of wandering around doing really nice things for people on the chance that, on a hunch that you have that maybe they're playing the game, and maybe they're not, and so you just help somebody across the street, which is totally nice, and it kind of comes to this massive conclusion where you just have these two giant teams who meet up at a location to nice each other to death, basically. There's a lot of really, really kind of interesting stuff, especially in the kind of location-based realm. Big games are really cool. There's a lot of people doing really neat stuff with big games.
I think, like, in particular with, the box and the geocaching idea, talking about the paperclip for a house thing, it's really interesting, like, how people value things.
Yeah.
Like, in particular, you have this very vague rule in it that just says, something of equal value. Like, what does it actually mean?
Is it sentimental
value
or
money? Yeah, value exactly. It's kind of interesting, like, what someone is willing to trade for something else.
Yeah, and those are the kind of implicit rules like you see in 16 Tons, right, where it's like, what happens with the money, And that's, Jason Beam really pointed out, because he was thinking about value when he was doing the trading, and it's such a good word, right, because value is such a different thing to different people. And someone might see the flash card for the DS, right, which has a very clear higher monetary value than an Etch-a-Sketch. And yet maybe you played with an Etch-a-Sketch when you were a kid, and all of a sudden it floods back these memories that you have. There's another component to it that I didn't really talk about, which is like the sacrificing of an object. And I think, too, that we tend to be beholden to our material objects too much. In giving it up, in sacrificing it to this game so that you don't have it anymore, if it's something of personal significance, you're letting go and being able to say, okay, the memory is one thing, I don't need to... and that's how it relates a bit back to Citizen Kane, which is a movie you should see, because it is good. It's everything they said it is. Depending on who they are.
Great.
Cool, thanks, guys.
Thanks.